Please welcome Sam Bass. He's got 35,000 hours. So you enlisted knowing how segregated the military was. You knew about the things we heard in the movie. Yeah. So what was the passion in you that pressed you to go ahead and say, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make this happen, despite all the negativity?
Well, I had grown up, you know, you treat other folks like you want to be treated, and you take part in what's going on. The whole family ended up, my dad was in the service as a chaplain, my sister was a WAC, my brother went to signal school, I went to flying school. But it was all, as I say, the attitude around the country to me at that time didn't change segregation. But it was, everybody was interested in the opportunities that the war buildup meant for the country.
George?
Well, we get back to this thing of why did I want to fly?
Right.
And one of the things that impressed me was the Battle of Midway. You know, the capital ships were hundreds of miles from each other, and the pilot, the planes, made a difference. They ended the battle without the ships coming close, and we won on that. And in fact, that was the start of the downfall of battleships too, because of planes. And that inspired me to an extent to fly. And in 1943, when I thought about flying off of a carrier, but the Navy wouldn't take Afro-Americans as pilots, but the Army and the Navy in 43 said, if you are 17, I went to the Navy first. I passed the exam, and they realized who I was, and they failed me on my physical. Right. I said, well, what did I fail? It was my teeth, they said. My wisdom teeth weren't in fully. I went to the dentist and said, nothing's wrong with your teeth. See? Now, here, these are all my original teeth in my mouth now, say, in the Navy. So then I went to the Army on the 17th of March, and I passed the physical and the exam, and that's it.
So how much...
But it shows the racial problem in the Navy at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How much did your parents' values affect your values and your attitudes about realizing you could make whatever you wanted to make out of your lives? What was their influence?
Well, to me, as I say, I was glad to have parents and grandparents that said, get an education. In other words, go to high school, go to college, because then you're prepared to walk through doors that open. You don't want to go up to the door and knock, and the door opens and say, oh, but you're not qualified.
Right. George?
Well, the thing is that although segregation existed, my parents still felt this was a land of opportunity, and you can make it if you try hard enough. And right. They encouraged me, because my mother didn't want us to go to war, but there were seven of us in the family. My older brother had gone in, and so I went in too.
Right.
But it's something she had to live with.
So you get down into the South, right, at Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. How much of that was an eye-opener for either of you in terms of how you were treated?
Well, it was certainly an eye-opener because you were facing things that didn't exist, at least, as I say, where I grew up. And even though I went to the University of Illinois, there was some segregation in town, but the school was open. The opportunity was there, and so it was good to be able to take advantage of that at the time. And as mentioned earlier, wasn't aware of some of the attitudes that existed or those that were saying you can't do something.
Right. George?
Well, when I went into service in 1943, I actually entered active duty on the 13th of July, 43. I met two other fellows from the Philadelphia area who were going to Tuskegee. And the three of us were put on a train to go to Biloxi, Mississippi for basic training. And they gave us Pullman tickets all the way, which was unusual. And it was nice sitting in a Pullman going to Cincinnati from Philadelphia in a dining car, seeing the scenery go by. We got to Cincinnati and got on the L&N Railroad to go to Biloxi, Mississippi. We still had the Pullman section for us. Everyone else in the car was white, but we had a Pullman section, the three of us. When we went to eat was the first difference.
Right.
They had to have segregation and eating facilities in the South. So the dining car had a heavy curtain across it with a few tables at the end. And we had to eat behind those curtains so that the white people couldn't see us eating in the car. That was my first introduction to real segregation. Then we got to Tuskegee and got off and went to Biloxi, and it was worse. It was complete on the base, yes.
How?
We were completely segregated.
Describe.
Completely segregated. We had our own orderly room. We had our own barracks we stayed in. And Keister Field had thousands of people there. And they had about 10 or 11 dining halls. And we had one on the end for us to eat. That's all. And that's the way it was at Keister. The Army was rigidly segregated then.
Yeah.
Army and the Navy, all the whole military, yes.
So you're in basic primary, right? You're in primary,
no,
flying.
No, this is basic.
Basic training.
Basic training. That is right. Learning to be a soldier.
Right.
Using weapons and things like that, the ground troop. Everybody in the Army goes through that.
So. Right. Mm-hmm. So you get to primary pilot training, though. What are you flying?
Well, I flew the PT-17 bi-wing open cockpit. But we need to say that our presence there was because of Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University. The city of Tuskegee and their sheriff wasn't a friend. If it had not been for Tuskegee University's very well-managed civilian pilot training program, and that's where Eleanor Roosevelt visited, if you recall some of that history, who knows what would have happened. And even the first white commander of Tuskegee Army Airfield didn't want a black soldier at the gate carrying his weapon because he didn't want a white person from Tuskegee coming out and being faced by a black with a gun. But fortunately, he was moved on. Noel Parrish took over. He didn't change segregation, but he believed in the opportunity and did everything to keep things smooth and continuing.
Right. So you're in the PT-17, right?
Yes.
So how long a period was that, and what was your next airplane?
PT-17, about 250 horsepower. That's primary training. Basic training was the BT-13, closed cockpit, a few more instruments, and you learned a few more things about flying. And advanced training at that time was the AT-6, another couple hundred horsepower in your strength. But even along the way, somewhere there you learned night flying, you learned instrument flying, and then in the final phases you learned combat performance in the aircraft.
Do you remember your first solo?
Yes and no. Do you, George?
Not really. It was so long ago. No.
What about when you were winged, when they pinned your wings on?
Well,
I just wonder what that experience meant to you, that's all.
Yeah, well, I remember more of my very first flight when the instructor said, "You see over there the airfield they're building?" I think I said yes, but I didn't want to be held to that.
So you're both winged. Now you come along later.
I came along, yes.
Yep.
He graduated in 43. I graduated in 44.
44.
September 44.
We were chatting inside about Benjamin Davis and Chappie James.
Yes.
Both African-American leaders, for sure. Where were they in that whole process, and how important were they to African-Americans being able to fly?
Well, Chappie James was an instructor in Tuskegee Institute Civilian Pilot Training Program. And they were all, of course, civilians, and I was in part of my training. They wanted them to come on active duty, and they wanted to stay as civilians. So they were given a choice, and while I was still in training, Chappie James decided to come on active duty. So he immediately, because of his experience, he didn't go through pre-flight, he went direct to basic on through and graduated. And as you know, his history after that, he strapped on many an aircraft.
Right. So you headed, once you've finished training, you get your wings, how soon before you went to Europe?
For me, training, we were immediately, Tuskegee Army Airfield was so crowded that that our combat training took place in Michigan. Osceola Army Air Base was a northern place where we could do gunnery out over the lake without much traffic and that type of thing. But we were combat ready by December 1943. No, but I have to say that that is the 332nd Fighter Group. The very first squadron that was an experiment expected to fail and didn't, 99th Pursuit Squadron, and they were combat ready in December of 42 when I first reported. No white commander wanted them. They kept in training for another 3 months. Spring of 43, they finally sent them to North Africa, a task to the 33rd Fighter Group. Momeyer didn't want them. They went to their own base, sent a pilot over to the 33rd to get their briefing, came back through their missions. But he said, not aggressive, should be patrolling Liberia. Well, if you remember your history and your map, where's Liberia? Where were the Germans? I think you get the idea.
Right. But